because she's a motherfucking hustler.
Welcome to Groovy Movies. My name is Lily Austin.
And my name's James Brailsford. Hello.
Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm pretty damn good, thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm exhausted, but I'm very excited for this subject because this week we are talking about women editors.
One of the few creative roles in Hollywood that does appear to be quite, I wouldn't say dominated, but there's a certain, a big female representation, and not just representation, a lot of their films, women edited films, have won Oscars and are parts of classic films.
Yes, yeah, totally. All right, so before we got into the kind of history of women editing and why is it they've come up, I thought for those of us who don't know, I was hoping, James, you could give us a rundown of what exactly editing is.
Sure, no problem. I mean, first off, full disclosure, I love editing as a process and as a creative technique. And I actually worked for the first 3 years of my career in television as an avid editor, as an editor.
Yes, so, I was going to say, you are a resident editor, so you can answer this question.
And so they say that a film is made three times. They say that it's made when it's been written, when it's been directed, and when it's been edited. So you'll have all this separate footage, but that's not a film. You can't show that on the big screen. So then an editor, they take those rushes and they look at the script, but they also look at the performances that they're given, the footage that's shot, and then they piece each part of the rushes together to create the film and create the meaning. There's a couple of different types of editing. There's like the editing in a scene. So let's say two people are having they're flirting with each other, then the editor chooses when they cut from one shot to another shot, when they cut to the person talking and the person listening, the reaction shots. That's one big part of editing. But the second part, and the part which I think is almost the most invisible part, is structural editing, is taking those scenes and then, you know what, we've realized that scene needs to go near the front of the film, or perhaps that scene doesn't work and we need to get rid of it, but now it doesn't make sense. Why is that character there and there? You know, even emotionally or geographically. So there's like a wider scale of editing, which is structural for the whole film. So there's pacing within the scene, and then there's pacing of the film in total. I would say that's a general gist of what editing is, as I can give you.
That's good. I mean, they say, right, with editing that successful editing goes unnoticed.
Yeah.
It's,
and
it's out of sight, you could say.
Oh, I see what you did there.
That's a film we'll be coming to later, listeners.
Oh, smooth. Yeah, I mean, that's it. Like, really good editing. When I watch a film, I suppose I'm always almost constantly thinking about what the directorial choices are, and I'm often thinking about the cinematography. But the editing one is the one that can sneak under the radar a bit, because if it's well executed. But then some films, they make a feature of particular, what we might say, tricksy editing too. And so there are occasions where you might be aware of the editor's work, and it's more visible. But a lot of the hard work that goes on with a good editor is invisible to the audience.
This was definitely my trickiest to prepare for in terms of watching the films, because normally when I watch the films that we're going to talk about, in my ideal world, it's I watch and then I watch again and take notes when I watch again, but often I don't have time to do the two viewings, so it's just watching and occasionally taking notes. But obviously if you're trying to watch something to like look at the editing, you really can't. I mean, you shouldn't really, I feel naughty even looking away at all, but you cannot look away because then you'll literally miss the whole thing. So it was, once you get into the film, like at first with each film, I would be really focused on it for the first sort of 5-10 minutes. And then a good film you get into, and then I just like couldn't even notice what was going on.
This was happening all the time for me with these three films as well, which again is an absolute testament to how good the editing is that even though we're trying to analyze it, you get sucked into the story. Because as well, I have to say, I don't know if it's a spoiler here, but just basically these were three great films. I loved watching them, rewatching them. These are like strong, well-made films, regardless of what you may or may not think about them in general, but they're beautifully done, kind of pieces of Hollywood entertainment that so you are sucked into them, and it's hard to pull yourself back out. I had to almost concentrate on select scenes and just focus my energy on that to be able to get something.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yes. Well, Shall we discuss the bit that I'm really excited to hear about, James? Because this basically, this whole topic for this episode came a few months ago when James said to me, did you know that women have been part of editing and the big films in Hollywood history from pretty much the get-go? And he began telling me the story of how they came to...
How that happened.
Yes,
how that happened. Because it's so male-dominated. How did it happen that women found themselves in one of the most creatively influential roles in filmmaking? If you can literally restructure an entire film, then that means that your skill and your ability can make or break a film.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So how did it happen? I want to refresh the story for me.
So I've had a look around, and it's hard to find like first-hand interviews with people who say this is exactly how it is. But in the early days of cinema, if you think of the very, very first films that were made, they were short subjects. Not only were they short subjects, but didn't have any shots in them. They had one shot, and it'd normally be a wide shot that didn't move, and the action happened in front of the camera. So, the editing,
just like a theatre.
Yeah, exactly. Like being at the theatre. That's exactly what almost all the films of Georges Méliès are just one locked off wide shot. So editing was really just like, well, you just need to physically snip the start and snip the end, and there's your film. And so it was there was no art to it in the very, very early days. And then even when film developed, so we had multiple shots, actually it would normally be one sequence. Let's say it's a bank robbery, you'd have one wide shot that doesn't move outside a bank, then they would walk into the bank and you would cut to another wide shot inside the bank. So there's not much artistry there, but in fact it's like it's literally stitching film, because back in the day you weren't working on computers and Premiere, you were literally using the film stock and you were sticking them together with like cement and paste, right? So it was seen as a form of like knitting or sewing, because you were joining things together. So it had this like, it was given this, it was essentially considered like an administrative chore.
Like a woman's job. If it's like sticking cuttings together, this is kind of in the domestic sphere of what women do well.
Absolutely. So let's give all the women this job, because the men, we're going to go out and direct movies because we're men, grr. But then guess what happened? So in Russia, we had Sergei Eisenstein revolutionizing editing with things, films like Battleship Potemkin.
Yes. Great film. Watch it, uni.
great film. But very, even now, the editing feels very modern. It's very kind of like, you notice the editing. It's part of the effect of the film is the way it's cut together, these striking juxtapositions. And so he was the filmmaker really who suddenly made editing an art form. It suddenly wasn't just sticking some shots together. And then in America, you had the directors experiment with cross-cutting, something so traditional now we don't even think of it. So let's say there's a building on fire in a film. You have shots of the building on fire. You have people inside the fire. You then cut away to the fire engine driving along. Then you cut back to the fire. The fire's getting worse. You cut back to the fire engine. That's called cross-cutting. We don't even think about that as a revolutionary technique, but that was groundbreaking. So suddenly you had this push of very artistic editing in Russia and very like dynamic editing, let's call it, in America. And the people who were administrating those cuts were women who'd been considered to be doing a menial task. They were now like on the front row of like this revolutionary form of storytelling, and they were there. They were embedded.
I mean, that is an amazing kind of step in the art of film evolving, to think that when it first began, that wasn't part of the storytelling at all. How the film was shot, and that came later. I mean, it makes sense, but it's kind of amazing to think how that had to be developed, and now it's such an important part of it.
Yeah, in the early days of cinema, where the grammar of film was still being worked, still being figured out, it just so happened that women were it's a bit glib to say right place, right time, but they were uniquely placed for when this grammar was being discovered and the rules were being made. They were right in the middle of, they got caught up in this, the fact that they happened to be in this particular job that did suddenly become creative from what originally, for quite a few years, was just seen as you just chop the start and you chop the end, and that's the end of editing.
Yeah.
I mean, they were called cutters back then. They were called cutters because you were literally going snip, snip. And then it kind of transitioned to picture editor once they became more of a storytelling part to it.
But I did read that then as the more of this artistry and storytelling came into editing, men began to muscle into those roles, of course, and lots of women were pushed out or deliberately passed over.
Yeah, I mean, what surprised me, I was doing a bit of research today for this podcast, just to try and look into the early history and to try and get more first-hand sources, but apparently in the 20s, there were even quite a lot of women who headed up their own independent film production companies, because back then, back in this like early days of cinema, it was a bit like it is now. It's a bit more of a hustle where people would do many jobs, so you might be own your own independent studio. You might shoot it, script it, direct it, and edit it all yourself.
Oh, no way.
And of course, what happened is, this is the 20s, but by the 30s, men had got into all the positions in power in Hollywood. So it was a bit more, there was just a bit more freewheeling in the 20s, from my understanding of it. But then that's the big change that happened. The corporatization of Hollywood.
I was going to say, it sounds like the sort of professionalization of establishing roles for each different part of the process of making
and film. And then managerial, and of course managerial must be men back then, of course, so that just kind of that pushed out very quickly women from, you know, it was essentially the one role that survived for women was editing, whereas all the other kind of things that like the women directors, the studio heads of the 20s, they just kind of got pushed out.
You know what it reminds me of? Twitter. You know how they say that when Twitter first launched, there was like a few, I don't know if it was months or perhaps years, the early days at least, it was predominantly women on there, women writers and journalists. And it was a lovely place where everyone just tried to entertain each other, and it was all very friendly and chatty. And then over time, it got kind of overrun. I mean, I don't want to compare men in film to like the trolls on Twitter.
On Twitter. But we will just do for lols. Come on, why not?
For a weak analogy. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, that must have been so exciting with this new industry that everyone was figuring out. This was the space where they could make their own. And then, of course, the men come in, take over and make it rubbish and push them out.
Right. For a few years, it sounds like pretty exciting times, you know, to be a woman and to be, say, I'm a studio head, I make films, you know, that must have been cool. And then
incredible. Yeah.
So that's kind of how this situation happened. But you're quite right. Like, I suppose it's one of the few areas of filmmaking where guys had to get into the industry rather than be de facto part of it, you know. So, you know, some of the most well-known editors are guys like Walter Murch and Michael Kahn. So there's a lot of guy editors, but there's still, it's still not entirely dominated by men, and it never has been.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking into it a bit and trying to get some stats of like percentage of women editors, like you said, in the 20s, and then kind of each decade, because today it's only 18% of editors are women, and that's higher than directors, which is 11%, but not much higher. So, and I was just wondering how that has ebbed and flowed, because I've definitely read a lot about how, yeah, there was this point early on where more women were in these roles, and then it's kind of basically in more recent years, kind of since the 80s, it's really depleted.
Yeah, it's difficult to find those particular statistics. The percentage is not particularly big, but I would say if you look at the percentage of those editors who then go on to work on some of the biggest and best films and win a lot of awards, it's a very well-performing 18%.
Yeah. because it wasn't of all women editors. It was 18% of the top, I think, 200 films to have been released.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, I see. Got you. That is a shame, isn't it? Sorry. Didn't realize.
Specify that. Yeah. I was curious if it was the number changed kind of industry wide, but I just couldn't find any statistics on that. But yeah, out of, I believe, 200 films, I'll put the study in the show notes. But
God damn it. Yeah, it makes me want to do some little research to get those stats. It would be very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, we should look into it. But having said that, like you said, some of the most successful films, and also films which their success was a large part down to the editing. The editing was recognised. So on that note, we're going to look at three women editors that James very kindly selected as his area of expertise. And we're going to look at a film of each of them and why the editing is so brilliant.
Great, yeah. I mean, we're going to kick off with Verna Fields, who the film we watched was Jaws, and she won an Oscar for the editing in it. And I have to say, I'm not sure I've ever watched Jaws all the way through ever. Maybe once when I was a little kid.
I watched it after going to Universal Studios. Remember the Jaws bit at Universal Studios? And I remember enjoying it. Steven Spielberg's film, for anyone not aware. But watching it this time, I was having the best time. I think it's actually one of my favorite films. I absolutely loved it.
Oh, it's like it's
exciting.
Yeah, it's so well directed. John Williams on the score, you know, great cast, great. It's like it's got everything that you want from, you know, it's a thriller as well. It's got some fun bits. It's got nice human interpersonal drama.
And I have to say that because I came to Jaws through the ride at Universal Studios, you go on this sort of...
Sorry, that's like, I came to Jaws from the book by Peter Benchley. No.
You know what? Like so many...
That's great. It worked though. Like what a great thing. The ride got you to watch the film.
Now that we're talking about it, I actually wonder if going to Universal Studios when I was 10 was the formative experience that made me love film, because it introduced me to so many movies. Psycho, The Mummy, Backdraft, unfortunately. But yeah, with Jaws, so you go on this tour bus around the studios, and along your way, you're given these sort of jump scares or entertaining moments where you engage with something from one of the films. Like you see the psycho house and you see the mother come to the window and that kind of thing. Anyway, at one point you go by and then Jaws itself like comes at you. I remember thinking it's not very scary and it's kind of silly and a bit whatever. So I didn't really get it. And I think that was what was in my mind when I was watching it this time. But when you actually watch the movie, this does really speak to the editing. That shark is terrifying. And the whole, every scene with them in it, on the beach, in the boat, it's absolutely thrilling. And I think, having seen that, you know it's not really about the fake shark, it's about how it's cut together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why she got the Oscar, is that she made it a scary thriller, even though the production history of Jaws, it's like it went 100 days over schedule, which is insane, because they had a lot of problems with the mechanical motorized shark that was meant to be able to do all these things. And so they had to essentially cut around it, so because the technology was just breaking down.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, they had huge problems with the shark, so it just, you know, Steven Spielberg was convinced, you know, it was going to just be to the detriment of the film. So you like me being a film nerd, you can definitely see it's not a great shark, but it's cut down so quickly that you know it gets away with it. I mean, the fact is, Jaws is seen as a classic, so it was. What they had was edited in such a way that it didn't just bring the whole film down.
And quite the opposite. I mean, Verna Fields won an Oscar for Jaws.
Absolutely.
Right?
And one of the things I was thinking about was that Jaws does have a character, and the character is because of the way it's directed. It's because of John Williams' music, and it's also because of how it's edited. You know, you can feel it terrorizing that boat towards the end. You know, but that's a character
almost
trait.
Messing with them, playing with them,
And so like when I started watching this though, I did start thinking, oh shit, you know, because it wasn't the best one for editing, because Steven Spielberg's directing style, he paces his own dialogue sequence, because often things run as one long master shot with a moving camera. So
right,
people will talk, but he doesn't just cut into close-ups of faces. There will be people moving. It's really good blocking. Like, so there's this dynamic camera move, and there'll be characters talking to each other. And then, you know, that lasts for maybe 35, 40 seconds before we then cut to another one of those shots. So it's not really showing off what the editor does, because he's keeping the camera so dynamic. So at first I thought, God, maybe this is not. But then as the film progresses, when suddenly there are sequences on the boat that are all about cutting between different shots, then you can see the work of the editor, and the fact that behind the scenes she made the shark work, you know. And then there are small beats, like the one scene I said to watch out for you to watch is was between Brody, the kind of main character, and his son back at home, and the son's mirroring his dad's body language.
Yes, Yes, I look closely at that.
Because that to me, because it's very hard when you watch a film to think, well, where was the, maybe that was the director's idea all along. Maybe Steven Spielberg said, right, I've shot this sequence and here's the shot, so we're going to use that one, that one, that one. You do exactly what I say, Werner. And that may have happened, but the thing is, editing's a collaboration, but certainly you can see that an editor very much could have had a lot of leeway to make that scene work, you know, because you were dealing with a child actor. I imagine there was a bit of improvisation. So there was a close-up of the child, close-up of the main character. And it's when do you decide to cut away between those two characters? How best to show the relationship, the kind of bond between father and son with the way that you cut between the shots?
Right, yeah. I got the sense that it was like creating some intimacy. You could tell how much they love each other and how close they are. But I don't really know how it was doing that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a bunch of different things. It's the way the scene has been directed on set, the way it's been performed, and then the way that those rushes have been put together. Because, for example, Werner could have just kept it all on a wide shot, because it starts off on a wide shot. You see both characters in the shot. You see the father and the son, and then in the background, in the depth of the shot, you see the mother. So you see three characters. She lets that shot run for a while, then she chooses to cut in, because then you realise, oh, yeah, he's mirroring his dad. And then you cut to see the dad noticing that he's mirroring him. So now you're allowing, from the choice of a close-up of Brody's face, you're like, oh, he's now aware that his son's doing that. And so now they're having a joke together. And that was told with the choices that the editor made of when to cut and which shot to go to. So that's emphasizing the performance that was there on set by how you edit it together.
I see.
Which is what makes something cinematic, because if you know, because otherwise it's a piece of theatre. If it's just a wide shot, then it's kind of like theatre. But editing is a cinematic technique that can work with an actor's performance.
Yeah, because it creates a feeling right between them. It like if it's mirroring that, you can get a stronger sense of how they're feeling.
Yeah,
I think that. See, I'm getting to why I don't enjoy theatre very much, and I love film. It's not just because I'm like a heathen. It's because it's so much more, everything is working to tell the story in the most engaging way.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I love film so much. I mean, I think that's why we get on so well and do this podcast, is because it's, you know, cinema is like this synthesis of all the different art forms. There's a bit of literature, a bit of drama, a bit of technology, you know, a bit of, you know, there's all lots of different things, and they're all meant to be working in harmony to the finished effect. And Jaws is beautiful for that, because it draws you in with a family drama, but then half, well, not a family drama, but like a human interest drama. Then the last half of the film is like this absolute thriller roller coaster ride.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking Jaws was one of Werner Field's earliest films? She started off as a sound editor, right?
Right. Well, now is a good time, because there's a couple of things I'd like to tell you about Werner's life from just what I was researching. But just to start at the end, a bit of editing there for you. We'll start at the end. Jaws was the last film she ever directly edited. It was the last film she ever. And I'll come to explain why later. So let's rewind back to Werner Field's past. So it's the Second World War, and she's going with her friend to serve coffee to the GIs as part of her war effort. She's like a teenager, I think.
Sure, war effort.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, sure, Werner. I would have done the same, honey.
And her friend she's with is like, before we go and give coffee to the GIs, why don't we go, I want to introduce you to my boyfriend. He works as an edit assistant at like a film lot. And she's like, oh, cool, let's go. And so the guy who let them into the studio lot, she was like, oh, he's really cute. So she used to start hanging around the film, I don't know if it was Paramount or wherever it was, but she used to start hanging around to hang out with this guy.
No way. That's so cute.
And she was hanging out so much with this guy who was an assistant sound editor. And she was hanging out with him so much that Fritz Lang, the fucking director, was like, who is this woman who keeps hanging around? We should give her some work. And so she got, with no qualifications, with no background, she got given an assistant sound editor's position for Fritz Lang.
Right? Oh my God. Different time. Different time.
Right. So she gets married to the cute guy.
Yes, she does. Yes, Werner. Good job, girl.
I mean,
she got a job and a husband out of it. That is, yeah, she's got game.
She's got good game. And so they have a couple of kids, and she spends 8 years raising the kids, right? So her career stops to do the traditional, she's a wife at home with the kids.
Good,
and
quite right.
I think it's Sam or Sid Fields, her husband. But anyway, he's working now as a sound editor. It's all going well. That, you know, the family unit is set up. And then, unfortunately, he dies. So very suddenly, he dies. And so she's now left with, I think, two kids to raise and no husband bringing the money. So she manages to get work as an assistant sound editor, then a sound editor. And she works out of the pool house at the back of her property as she sets up an edit suite. And the production companies let her take off the afternoon to serve her kids dinner. Then when she puts them to bed, she works until 2 a.m. So as a single mother raising kids in Hollywood, she was also working as a sound editor, and she did that for like 6 or 7 years. Then she transitioned into being a picture editor.
Whoa, that is insane. Wow, what an amazing life.
So Jaws was edited in that pool house.
It was edited.
That's how you worked with Verna Fields. You went round to her house and she had an edit suite in the back of her house.
Because she needed to be at home with her kids.
Raising the family, yeah.
Wow. God, that's crazy. Well, I read that she was nicknamed Mother Cutter.
Yes. This brings me to another thought that I've had about one of the things about female editors. And I found a quote by Tarantino.
Yes.
Tarantino did an interview. And Sally Menke, I think is how you pronounce it. Sally Menke edited all of his films from Reservoir Dogs until Inglourious Basterds in 2009. She passed away in 2010, which is why she no longer edits for him. But he said he wanted a female editor because he wanted, these are his words, he wanted somebody who he felt would nurture him as a filmmaker and nurture the film. He didn't want to get into male ego, proving points, trying to say this is how we do it. He didn't want that kind of dynamic. And so I think Verna Fields, I mean, the nickname was Mother Cutter, she worked with George Lucas on his earlier films. She worked with Steven Spielberg, who was clearly an amazing talent, but he had no, you know, for example, I heard that she did a lot of liaising between him and the studio because he was in his 20s, so he didn't have much experience, didn't have much, you know, use, he didn't have much knowledge of doing all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of stuff she did above and beyond her editing role that kind of nurtured his talent.
And I think we're getting to perhaps an explanation as to why women have, even as they were starting to be pushed out of editing, as it became a more creative and more basically more important role within filmmaking, how some women still manage to stay in these roles. I think because the dynamic between a director and editor is such that a lot of male directors like to have a mother figure around to help them without them feeling competitive. And I think... I don't know. It's sort of a slightly depressing thing to kind of realize.
As far as you may have come in this creative career, you're still essentially being seen. You're still having to perform the role of as a mother.
Exactly. You're still, you know, these are the roles women are given, right? It's either sexy object of interest, of attraction, or kind of mother figure. You know, those are the roles women have. Like historically, traditionally, these are our archetypes. And yet again, in this field in which they are most successful, that is because this is kind of where they have succeeded, is if they're able to be in this like nurturing kind of hospital role. And that's not to kind of put down any woman editor who occupies that space. Like that makes, you know, it's like whatever, if that works for you, then fine. But it's just slightly depressing that that's still that kind of setup is there. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, there's an element of it clearly seems to work in the system. You know, you're not going to make it as a female editor, if a woman editor, if you are just a very nurturing person. You need to be able to edit. So
yes, but I wonder if, are you able to make it as a female editor if you're a brilliant editor but not a nurturing person. Because, you know, not all women are maternal and nurturing.
Yeah, I mean, and also I'd like to say nurturing isn't particularly gendered as such. It can
exactly.
be.
Exactly, absolutely.
So the point I'm trying to get to, my experience of spending my entire adult career in edit suites of some degree or another is that the best editors you work well with are really good at cutting and really kind of nurturing. Like, and I work with a lot of male editors, but it's the same thing. What you don't want in an edit suite is unnecessary confrontation, unnecessary ego. You want somebody right, who's supportive, yeah. like especially as a director in TV, you're often quite burnt out. It's been a long day, so you're in the edit suite, and you know there are editors who are just like, "Don't worry, come on in, it's fine." We're like, "Ah, oh, that's what I want to hear. That's what I need to hear." So that I would say, and when I was an editor, I tried to make sure that everyone felt really kind of like comfortable, safe, like we had a laugh, you know, and that I was interested in the project and them. So like, I think it's part of the toolkit of being a successful editor, but
I think that, I mean, that makes sense,
you know. And also I think the creative process usually is the best when it's a collaborative process where it's fun. And so when you're in that edit suite for 6 months, you know, you want to be having fun because the creativity will come. If it's like, God damn it, that editor's like so egotistical or whatever, you know, it's going to impinge on the creative process. So
and you want to feel comfortable and safe because then you can really like try things out. Juices will flow.
Yeah, you know, like some of the most creatively satisfying times of my life have been in an edit suite working with an editor. I mean, shout out to Claire McGonigal, like at film school. She edited all of my films at film school, and it was some of the highlights of my life was discussing why the film's not working. You know, all the things I just said about what editing is, we did in our short films, including like totally restructuring a film that we'd scripted and shot one way. We restructured it from the ground up in the edit, which it wasn't meant to be like. So figuring those things out, it's like so exciting because each day you're like, well, I'm not quite sure how we're going to do this, but between us we'll figure out. So you're trying things out. But,
and that's what's so amazing about film, right? Like I always think of that with, that's what they say about Annie Hall, right? Was that the film that Woody Allen had in mind and the film that he shot that was in his mind while they were shooting is nothing like the film that we have today. That was completely created in the edit suite.
Yeah.
And that's so crazy because you don't know. Like we said, good editing, you don't even see.
The genius is where you've done a lot of work behind the scenes, but to the audience, you don't even notice. That's like the true, you know, that, which of course, how hard is that to quantify? I just wanted to wrap up Verna's story because we parked it out like she won the Oscar for Jaws, so why did she never edit another film again? And it's because I think it was Universal. Yeah, of course, Universal she was with. They offered her a managerial role. They made her like vice president of feature film production. And she was the first woman, I think, to be offered that in Universal. It was like a big deal. Now all the people who called her mother cutter, like Lucas and Spielberg, they thought she'd sold out, but she actually says in an interview, very interesting, that she can do more for them now in this role than she could ever do when she was an editor because she got more power.
Absolutely. And I reckon she could probably at that point hire a nanny and not have to work out of her pool house anymore.
You'd hope the kids have left home by then and they're not still in the house.
It was just quite a few years after.
Oh yeah. She raised the kid in the late 50s, early 60s, and then in 76 was Jaws. So I imagine she just got used to working out of her own house, and so it's like, well, you come round to my edit suite or you can fuck off.
All right, cool. Well, shall we move on to our next lady? Thelma Schoonmaker.
Thelma Schoonmaker, yeah. I'm a big fan of Thelma Schoonmaker. I even I saw her do a talk at the BFI like 15 years ago.
Cool. What was she like? Nice vibes?
Really nice vibes. Just what you can't imagine listening to her is and looking at her just from like judging books by her cover. What you can't imagine is she works with Martin Scorsese. She seems such a like a nice, like she might make you a cup of tea and say, "Oh, James, how's your day been?" You just feel like she's super nurturing.
Yeah,
you're right. Super like grandma energy. But like you think, fucking hell, she's edited all these bangers with Scorsese, all these violent films. It's like this.
Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street, Grandma Evans. Yeah. Just imagine her cutting that scene with Margot Robbie in the kids' playroom. Oof.
Right? I mean, she's been right in the forefront of all those films. So, it's the disparity about someone's, what you imagine their image is from just seeing and listening to them and their work and their creative output. She's a genius, yeah.
I love it. So you wanted us to discuss Raging Bull, which Thelma won an Oscar for as well. Why did you want to discuss it?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I've never seen it, even though I should have done. Two, it won an Oscar for editing. Because the way that I kind of collated these films was essentially look at the nominees for editors. Specifically, I think you can find on Wikipedia the female with the women nominees for editing throughout the history of Hollywood. So, And I have to say, if you're ever wondering what film to put on, you haven't got a clue, bring up that list, because it's a really fucking, they're all strong films on there, because a lot of films that won the Best Picture or Best Director Oscar, a lot of them haven't aged that well and they're not that good films, but the best edited films by female editors, I gotta say, it's a strong list.
I really, because I was gonna say, I feel a bit bad that we're being so Hollywood Oscar centric, because the Oscars often have some questionable nominees, but I trust your taste on this.
I mean, it's just a good rough sketch of, like, you know, if working your way around Hollywood, I think more the technical categories are way more interesting than Best Actor, Best Director, I think. So it was just, it won an Oscar, so I'd heard it's a great film, and I just haven't seen it, so I figured now is a good time to do it for the pod.
And we wanted to do it right as well, because Raging Bull, in case you guys, I just realised we didn't discuss the... We didn't give a plot summary of Jaws. I'm just assuming everyone knows.
There's
a big shark involved. With Raging Bull, we can similarly just say it's about boxing.
It's about boxing.
It's about a famous boxer.
Well, not that famous, but a bit of, you know, he was a good boxer, but a bit of a shit person. Right.
Jake LaMotta, played by Robert De Niro. Yeah, perhaps not a very famous boxer. I got the impression he was famous.
No, he was
not that big a deal.
I think what he is he had all the potential to have been like someone we would recognize the name of, and he just fucked it up because of his own, how he was as a person.
Right, yeah.
So he squandered his talent is basically the impression I get.
Yeah, well, that is definitely the impression you get in the movie itself, in Raging Bull. But yeah, so kind of on the, it's again a film I also like was on my list when I wanted to see, but probably had never got to, because it is a pretty masculine film, and if you want to be very simplistic in general about these things, I mean,
it's a film about boxing.
It's a film about boxing
set in the 40s and 50s, so it's not going to be a good time for the female characters in this film.
No, exactly. Yeah, so I think it was important to us, right, to like discuss some films that on the surface are like, could it be more masculine, but it was women who were doing the edit, and especially in this film, because the editing is really important in it.
This one, I would say there's clearly moments in the film where you notice the editing. There's a lot of, I think I read some of that each boxing match, they wanted to cover it in a different style. So the way that Scorsese directed it is different for each boxing match, but also the way it's edited. Sometimes they don't edit very quickly at all. They let the shots last a bit longer. Sometimes suddenly thud, 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 you'll be editing and there's a constant like little refrain of camera flat bulb flashes that's like really quick, like 4 or 5 frame edits of camera bulbs flashing, which are kind of, you get the idea of how distracting and how kind of, you know, reminding you that his life is constantly being documented by the media. So that's very noticeable editing in the film.
Which is your favourite scene from an editing point of view?
That's a good question. I've actually got more for the other two films than this as far as a particular scene. Was there any that stood out for you in here?
I think probably the final big fight scene with Sugar Ray Robinson.
Mm.
That stood out because from what I could see, it was like really well edited, and that there was so much kinetic energy that you could feel through the fast cuts and the shaky camera that's almost like a person in the ring between them or something.
Yeah.
And then lots of close-ups as well. But having said that, it was so visceral and violent that I could barely watch it. So I believe it to have been well edited, but I can't say for sure because I couldn't bear to look.
That last fight, you're right, it's brutal. It's brutal. Oh, but yeah, it is a masterpiece of editing. You're quite right. And again, I think the point is we've seen here, that's the total effect of how that was staged, how the actors performed it, how the camera moved, but how those individual shots were sequenced together, the rhythm, you know, the kind of long takes, then suddenly fast into cutting. How long do you choose to keep on each of those shots, you know?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I read that Scorsese was really unsure how best to edit that scene. So he got up the shower scene from Psycho and was like trying to replicate it shot by shot.
Amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah.
That makes it, because there is like, it's very stylized, that sequence. And it's clear that like in reality, he wouldn't, you know, there's loads of blood coming down him and sweat. It's over the top. But now it's like, oh yeah, of course. There's a shot of his feet with like loads of blood coming down. That's like Marion's right. foot in the shower of Psycho. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's that final scene at the end of the rope ring with blood dripping from it, which I guess is kind of like the blood dripping down the bath final shots.
I had no idea about that. It was fascinating.
Yeah. Oh wow, I'm so pleased I could bring one bit of information that you didn't know to this conversation.
it's a belter. Thanks. But yeah, I mean, Thelma Schumacher, I don't know too much about her story. I know that Scorsese struggled to get her on board as an editor because she wasn't in a union. And
yeah, that was interesting. I read about that. So there's this Motion Picture Editors Guild, which, well, I read some conflicting information about why she wasn't a member of the guild. Initially, I heard that it's an all-male guild, and that was why. Just like pure sexism, she wasn't allowed in. But then I read that
doesn't make sense because Velma Field was in the guild.
Well, right. And obviously, as we've discussed, there were a number of women editors in films. So that doesn't make sense. I don't know where, like, yeah, I forget where I read that. But then after thinking, God, that's outrageous. What a joke. I then did like further reading. And actually, it wasn't that at all. It was that she already had been nominated for an Oscar for the documentary Woodstock. She she edited that. That was her first proper job out of uni, where, as you said, she met Scorsese. And she did such a good job on that. And apparently that film was revolutionary in bringing up the artistry of documentaries. It opened up documentary to that kind of level of creativity. But she was then kind of established in that. Like, she didn't win the Oscar, but she got a nomination. And the process for becoming a member of the Editors Guild was you had to do an apprenticeship for 3 years, and then 2 years, I think it was, and then become an assistant for 3 years. You have to work your way up.
She skipped the queue, and so she couldn't get
in. Yeah, and that was the thing. She was like, "I'm not. Why would I be an apprentice when I've already had a proper job as an editor?"
Right.
To the point where I was nominated for an Oscar, like I'm established. So she had this really tough few years. She said, I mean, I understood their point of view, but it was also from my point of view, why would I do that? So it was just really tough. But in the end, like Scorsese managed to get her in.
Well, apparently she says she still doesn't know who it is who nominated her to get in. There's rumours that it's Al Pacino, apparently, which is...
Friends in high places. Well, yeah. I'm very glad she finally got in, because she didn't. Excellent job on Raging Bull.
I mean, you know, she's worked on all of Scorsese's films, I think, pretty much since Raging Bull.
Yeah. They worked together for like 50 years over the course of his career. And apparently when they were doing Raging Bull, they edited it together in his New York apartment after every day's shooting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a common thing. I mean, I know that Werner also was editing on a daily basis the footage that comes in. So you will often, as an editor, follow the film around the world as it's shooting. So you are there to get the rushes and to edit it. Because if you just waited till the end of the film being shot, you'd have like 60 days of rushes to get through and to edit the film together. Whereas if you've got a fighting chance of kind of keeping on top of it if you're doing it throughout the shoot.
Right. And I imagine you can also, if you edit as you go, you might see that something was missing that perhaps you could reshoot the next day or something.
Absolutely, that's a big part of it as well. But you know, but she clearly has such a great relationship with Scorsese, because he could choose to work with anybody, and he chooses every single time to work with her, because between them they've created some classics of cinema.
Yeah, and I really. The character of Jake LaMotta, as we said, is
deeply unpleasant. But that's the point.
Deeply
unpleasant.
But I don't know. I found it very compelling viewing. And I think that is down to... I mean, I will say, like with a lot of films that I complain about, it is slightly too long. I feel like we could have cut a few of those fight scenes. So apparently, in total, they don't even make up 10 minutes of the film.
But they're so powerful, though, are they, really?
They're so powerful. They're so relentless with his bloody nose. Oh, my God.
And which I think is another reason why they're so good, is that if there were too much boxing, you'd zone out. But because they're, like, really short and focused and, you know, they don't dominate the film, that when they do come in, you pay attention and they make an impact.
But also because they're so well edited that they do make this impact, that we only have a few minutes each time, but then they come back and you're like, oof, okay.
Yeah, yeah, because you feel like you've been assaulted by the film. The film's kind of attacking you.
That's it, exactly. Genius. Yeah.
But yeah, it was a pretty grim film. But I agree with you. I'm a bit like you that a lot of films are too long, especially I think Scorsese, for me, his later stuff, just could do with a bit of trimming down. The only film that I've watched of his recently where I'm like, for some reason, that doesn't feel too long was Wolf of Wall Street. And that made me think that's a masterpiece of editing to sustain 3 hours. But I can see from your reaction, Lily,
Well, I hate that movie, but you know what? I enjoyed Raging Bull, and there was something that I got out of The Last Temptation of Christ that I think I think maybe I need to do a full appraisal of Scorsese. You're unconvinced by that. Do you think no? Should I just leave it be?
I mean, it's a very entertaining film, but it is about a deeply unpleasant central character who it's making you want to like. Like, lots of my friends unironically love the central character of Wolf of Wall Street, whereas I'm like, no, I don't think that's the point. Like, I know it's Leo, and I know it's all fun and games, but just...
Yeah, whereas with Raging Bull...
It's quite clear that you're not meant to.
You're not meant to like him. You do feel for him. So it works. You don't leave... I didn't actually leave it feeling kind of... dirty, because I felt like we were all on the same page.
Yeah,
With Wolf of Wall Street, I was like, oh, I didn't like how I felt like that was trying to make me think.
Yeah, but and I think that was his intention, because unlike but Raging Bull, Wolf of Wall Street is not so black and white.
Yeah. Raging Bull is a black and white film, guys.
Thank you for explaining that joke there.
That was good, though. I like that very much. That's almost as good as my out of sight joke from earlier. Which, speaking of, shall we move on to Andy Coates?
Hell yes, Les. Yay, what a segue.
A smooth segue for once. Yay.
We did it. We did it. No turbulence today.
Yes. Okay, great. So, Andy Coates, why are we talking about her, James?
Because she's a motherfucking hustler.
Because let's
start at the end. Let's start with her very last credit, okay? Her last credit was a co-edited credit on 50 Shades of Grey, and she was 91 years of age.
Yes. Anne V. Coates, yes. She is an editor known for many things, but one of them is being very good at sexy sex scenes. And so, by God, they had to bring her in on 50 Shades. They need to try their best to save that.
We need,
poor film.
Like, literally, like, what else can we do to try and make this sexy? Well, I guess we could try and get Anne V. Coates. Isn't she dead? No, but she's in a retirement home, probably. I mean, she's 91.
She's still alive? Yeah.
Let's get her in then. Let's get her.
You know what? Yeah, when I was looking at her filmography, I saw that Unfaithful was in that. Have you seen Unfaithful? Oh, you're missing out. It's a film from the 90s starring Richard Gere and Diane Lane. And they play a married couple, and then she has an affair. She is unfaithful.
It is unfair. And oh, I see the titular.
Yes, it is unfair. And the titular Unfaithful. And I have to say, the guy that I feel bad for forgetting the name of the actor. I'm not sure what else he did besides it, but he's a very attractive man. And I watched that. I would say that was a formative film for me. I watched quite a few times at uni. It's very sexy. And V. Coates did a very good job on those many, many sex scenes. So I wish we'd done that. But no, we did Out of Sight. We did Out of Sight. But yeah.
Which has like a bit of a sizzle to it, you know?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Have you seen it before, Out of Sight?
I've never even heard of it. This is a film directed by Steven Soderbergh, by the way, guys. And I have to say, I didn't love this movie.
George Clooney, Jennifer Lopez, like a vehicle for both. You know, very early Jennifer Lopez before she was J-Lo, you know.
Yeah. She looks so young. Well, they both do.
Yeah, I loved this film when I saw it back in 98. I saw it at the cinema when it came out, and it was the first time I'd seen a film where I was like, I need to go and buy the soundtrack album, because I thought the music by David Holmes was so good. I really dug the editing. I thought it was a mixture of like classic smooth Hollywood editing, where just everything's very unobtrusive and you don't notice it. But also there's some much more obvious editing moments, and the scene which I think really sums up like Anne Coates' genius is the scene in the bar where finally because it's like George Clooney plays a criminal on the run, and Jennifer Lopez plays like an agent, like a federal, I can't remember if she's FBI or CIA. So obviously, they shouldn't get together, but they get together, and there's a bit of chemistry between them. And so it's simmering away for most of the film.
They fight a frisson,
and they meet in the bar finally, kind of towards the latter half of the film. And the way that sequence is edited, you've got everything there. You've got traditional editing where you cut from your wide shot to your close-ups. You've then got freeze frames. You've got intercutting because as they're flirting with each other, we cut to sequences of them actually starting to make out, and which is in a different room at a different time. So we're flashing forwards in time whilst we're also still seeing them flirting initially. So we know where it's going to lead because we can see it, but the way that it's intercut kind of builds up the tension of both things. And like one thing that I loved watching it closely was that when George Clooney sits down opposite her at the table in the bar, they start having a discussion and they're in character. They're role-playing as like, I can't remember, Craig and something. But they're both pretending to
She's
be like
Celeste.
Celeste, that's right. And like she works as a sales rep. Yeah. You know, so they're role-playing and the whole thing stays in on a two-shot. Like you see profile shots of both their faces. They're looking at each other and we do not cut. The camera doesn't move, I don't think. And then we finally cut to Jennifer Lopez just as George Clooney says, how long are we going to keep this up? And she just goes immediately, don't talk, don't ruin it, basically, she says. So Anne Coates deliberately chose to cut at that point because she would have had the footage to cut earlier, but she kept them on the wide shot while they're in character. And that moment when the break character, where they're playing and they're in this like flirty magic land, but when it cuts and she's like, oh, don't talk, she cuts to that shot of Jennifer Lopez. So the cut itself signifies the role play's over, the magic's just ever so slightly disappearing for a second.
Nice. I love that. Well, you've sold me on that aspect of it, but I will say that that scene was when I was really beginning to lose patience, because throughout the film, there's quite a lot, I know this isn't editing, but there's quite a lot of shaky hand cameras going on, right? Is that handheld?
You can call it handheld if it's a bit noticeably handheld camera work.
Yes, and I found it, I was starting to get a bit seasick. So in that scene, because it's all handheld throughout that scene and the scene that it's cutting into of them becoming intimate, that we're cutting between two shaky things. I was like, oh God. So I found it quite distracting because I couldn't really feel that tension because I was just so aware of the camera moving all the time with the cuts as well. It was like so much going on.
See, for me, I always like the kind of handheld, slightly more looser feel of that sequence because it reminded me, especially the kind of cutting around time, reminded me of the French New Wave. You know, I think there's a very clear influence of French New Wave filmmaking to the whole of Out of Sight, but almost specifically that sequence. It's almost like Anne Coates has gone, well, remember the French New Wave? He is like the modern take on that, where it's a bit more complex, a bit more editorially rich. But yeah, I'd never been distracted by the handheld camera at that point.
That's just my motion sickness. I blame it on that.
All right. God, you would have hated it at the cinema then, because I saw it on the big screen. Jeez.
Well, so Anne V. Coates, she has a very interesting history, right? We started at the end with her final film that I've now forgotten. What was it? Oh, 50 Shades, 50 Shades.
50 Shades was a final film, yeah.
Yes. And do you want to take us back a bit further? What else is in her oeuvre?
Well, the number one obvious one that you can quickly find is Lawrence of Arabia, for which she won the Oscar for editing. And it's seen as quite an innovative film editorially. There were a few things that she did that I think all of them had been done before, but I think it was the first time in a big Hollywood film that like these techniques have been foregrounded quite so much. So there were choices where ordinarily you might cut to close-ups, but she didn't, so she sustained a shot. There's the match cut, which is basically a straight cut between two entirely different scenes. So it's Lawrence of Arabia blowing out a match, and that cuts hard cut to in another country, the sun rising. So that's a match cut that immediately makes we don't have shots of Lawrence getting ready to travel, Lawrence in an airplane, Lawrence being greeted at the airport. The way that we transition from Lawrence being in one country to another is this hard cut. And the cut also matches the themes of the film. And that's a technique that was used, because remember, Lawrence Weber is 62, won the Oscar.
Right.
Stanley Kubrick, who watched every film that ever came out, would have definitely have watched that and been impressed by it. And in 1968, when he makes 2001 A Space Odyssey, we have what is the rival for the most well-known match cut in the history of cinema, which is obviously the cut between The Bone and The Spaceship, which is a conceptual cut, as well as getting us thousands of years in the future with one cut without like any explanation material. We're also conceptually cutting from the very first weapon that humans created, the bone, to, in the film, what we're not told this, but what we cut to is an orbiting nuclear weapon. So it's a conceptual cut as well as a traveling in time cut.
Genius, genius. It always comes back to Stanley Kubrick in the end, and I'm happy about that. Stanley also, or Nolan?
Stanley or Nolan. Well, there's still time, Lily. Don't you worry. It's like Jaws. It's like he's going to mention it.
I can see the fin coming towards me in the distance.
Just when you thought it was safe to listen to an episode of Groovy Movies where he wouldn't shoehorn in a Christopher Nolan reference. There's still time. But yes, but I thought it was interesting to point out that Kubrick, is like every other film director, gets inspiration from other filmmakers. And I think that's a clear one, that he will have seen that cut and gone, I want to do that and I want to put my own spin on it.
Yeah, love it. Love it. That is my favorite kind of editing. Let's skip ahead. We don't need to have all this exposition in between. Let's get to the next scene.
Well, you know, the thing is, one of the kind of the joke like comments made about editing generally is that the most boring thing in a film is entrances and exits, right? Is going in through doors and leaving a scene through a door. And when you start actually editing your own stuff, you are like, holy shit, when everyone shuffles through a door, are you kidding me? It takes forever. So part of the skill of the editor is to keep the story moving for all those things that when you're shooting on the set, somebody coming through a door or closing a door doesn't seem like anything really. But when you're watching the film, it just starts to drag them down. So
yeah. Keeping that pace up.
So see, that's the balancing act of like, how can I keep the pace going at the appropriate speed without it feeling too choppy? And I think all three of these editors are masters at that.
Yeah, totally. Well, on that note, shall we finish up with a few recommendations? Because as we were saying, yeah, there definitely does seem to be fewer and fewer women editing today. I'm concerned about it, James.
Yeah, absolutely. There are three editors from Hollywood history. I mean, oh, sorry, that's unfair. Thelma Schumacher still working and still delivering the goods.
She's still doing her good work.
Sorry, Thelma. Sorry, that was a little bit unthinking over there. But who are the new up and comers? Who are the new people making waves?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, my personal pick is Jennifer Lame. Started off doing a lot of Noah Baumbach films, but the most interesting transition is she edited Marriage Story, then the next film that she edited.
Love that movie.
Tenet.
Oh, very good.
And she's the editor of Oppenheimer, so she's now transitioned because Christopher Nolan, here we go, see, here's the reference. Christopher Nolan worked with Lee Smith for the majority of his career. Most of the films he's done has been Lee Smith, but then they parted ways before Tenet, and so Jennifer Lame came in, and all of her work up to that point has been like kind of family drama, small-scale stuff. She doesn't have a pedigree of doing any action films at all. She doesn't have a pedigree of doing big-scale Hollywood films, but Christopher Nolan liked the style of her editing, and he was like, you don't need to worry about these kind of like how to edit action, because he's basically done it for years, so he can definitely mentor her on the bits that she might not feel she's that strong with, but she had what he needed in other areas. And I mean, the thing is, she went from doing Marriage Story to doing Tenet, which I would say is possibly the most complicated film to edit in the history of motion pictures. May not be the best film ever or anything, but as far as how complicated that edit must have been, I can't even begin to imagine. It triggers my anxiety when I think about it. So baptism of fire there for Jennifer Lame, and you know, she pulled it off.
Wow, amazing. Well, yeah, similarly, I was thinking of Juliette Welfing, who's she's quite well known already. She's a pretty established editor. She's French, and she's done an interesting mix of things. So similarly, she's done a lot of like French indie films like Rust and Bone, which I really loved, and Paris 13th District that came out last year. But she also edited The Hunger Games. Ah. So she's an interesting editor, because throughout her filmography, there's a real mix of bigger Hollywood blockbusters and then these small, interesting indie films. She's got a nice balance.
Yeah. Because I imagine like working on a big Hollywood film must be fun and must be, you know, a lot of excitement, but there's also going to be a lot more technical stuff and there's going to be lots of visual effects to deal with. And there's a lot of different other concerns of working on a big Hollywood blockbuster than there are working on a smaller drama. So I imagine if you are an editor, you're probably going to want to mix it up and do a bit of both.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And then the other one I wanted to mention was Maya Mafioli, who she edited Beast, a film for a few years ago, and also Rocks, which is a film at the cinema that's like set in East London about like girls in at a school, like friends. And it's just a really moving, beautiful film. And she also did Ali and Ava, a film that came out a couple of years ago that's like very sweet as well. So like a really great kind of indie pedigree. So I'm excited to see what she does next.
Ah, great. Well, there's still some encouragement there that there's women editors coming through still.
Yes.
Excellent. And well, Lily, I think maybe it's time for me to ask you, do you fancy another visit to the film pharmacy?
Yes, please.
Today's film pharmacy is from one of our dear listeners. Thank you very much for sending it in. And if anybody listening has got a film pharmacy question, we would love to hear from you.
Yes, please. DM us or send us an email, groovemoviespod@gmail.com. Do carry on, James.
So our question today is, after watching the news, what film should I watch to restore my faith in humanity? I listen to a lot of news podcasts which infuriate me, but I like to stay informed. I need a film to reignite my faith in humanity.
Ah, very good.
Just not too big an ask, just to restore his faith in humanity.
That's a very good point. But I really, really empathize with this because I listen to a lot of news podcasts as well, and it can be seriously bum out.
Yeah.
So shall I share a couple of suggestions that I came up with?
Please do. Please do.
Well, actually, I mean, this. I say a couple. One was like the thing that immediately came to mind, but I feel like it's, God, I hope this isn't your one, but it's quite an obvious choice, which is Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh, great film.
It's a great film, but it's also like, I feel like it's the go-to film for like uplifting, quirky, kooky. It's like, it's almost too obvious. So I was not really satisfied with that. But if you haven't seen it, I would implore you. It definitely will lift your spirits. But then... So to go for something that's slightly less obvious, I then thought of Best in Show. Have you seen Best in Show?
Yeah.
So Best in Show is a mockumentary which follows dog show competitors and their owners as they go for gold in a Cruft style championship. And all the characters are so odd. It is so hilarious. And what's so kind of delightful about it is that there's something very accurate about their oddness, and yet it's so absurd. And so you feel like you're getting to something that's very true about humanity, which is we're all a bit weird and silly. And also it's so fun to watch because the stakes could not be lower. You know, they're competing in a dog show. Like, it really it's all very inconsequential. So I find that film incredibly uplifting. It's hilarious and just a real balm from reality.
And interestingly, Lee, your two choices are both films that centre around winning a competition. I wonder if that were...
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, both low-stakes competitions. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, my main thing was I really didn't want to go for like a rom-com or something too romantic, because I think that's all very specific to the person, what will lift you up and what will bum you out. So.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm worried that mine's a bit too obvious as well. So maybe this week's is just the obvious film pharmacy. What can I say? They can't all be obscure French films. Not that they ever are. But my suggestion would be, I've gone for a similar vibe as yourself, which is like kind of uplifting, heartwarming, people overcoming low stakes obstacles, which is the Full Monty. You know,
give yourself a great choice, a bit of
northern working class guys down on their looks who've got to try and get some money together at the last minute. You know, so good music, good laughs, and you know, also a little bit of socio political commentary, but it doesn't overwhelm the film.
It does touch on something quite important. It has real meaning and heart underneath, but it's very fun and entertaining and funny to watch. So it's a good balance. That is a great one. That's very good. Good choice.
Well, I hope between the three films there's something to cheer your spirits. Otherwise, I don't know what...
But, oh my God, I've recommended this before, but the other one is, if you want to go for something that is a little bit more heavy hitting in a sense, is Young Plato. I've talked about it before, the documentary about a school in Belfast where the principal introduces philosophy as a core subject. That will definitely uplift your spirits because you're seeing people actually do really important good work to help children who really need it. So that one's like a less fun, but it's great. That one, okay. I'd really strongly recommend. So all four, please.
Great.
All right. Well, I think that's enough for us, James. I think we should let the listeners go.
Yes, thank you for sticking with us. Yeah. And like and review and subscribe to everything.
Yes, subscribe. Give us a review. It really
press
helps.
Press things, heart buttons, press them, thumbs up. Thank you.
And we will see you next week.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Follow us on Instagram at groovymoviespod or email us groovymoviespod@gmail.com.
Groovy Movies was produced and edited by Lily Austin.
Music and sound by James Brailsford.
Our logo was designed by Abby Jo Sheldon.
For references and more information about the films discussed, check out the show notes.